Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts as they share with you the insider's guide to property investing.
All right, folks, you're on the Property Couch, your insider's guide to property investing. I'm Bryce Holdaway, co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia on Foxtel's Lifestyle Channel. He's Ben Kingsley, Chair of the Property Investment Professionals of Australia and also the current Property Investment Advisor of the Year. How's your week been, mate?
Good, always good. Love coming to work, doing what we do. It's fantastic.
Helping more people build some portfolios. Today we thought we'd cover off some Q&A that we're getting great feedback from our listeners. This one's from Andy Farr. Finance related is the subject. Hi guys, loving the podcast. I can squeeze exactly two episodes in on my way to work and I'm already concerned that I will soon run out of new episodes. Well, we can help Andy because as he gets towards the end of the podcast, they actually go a little bit longer than 20 minutes, so we probably won't be able to squeeze exactly two episodes in on the way to work.
But we can keep talking if you want, Andy. We can talk underwater.
Exactly. We'll do a few in-between sides soon. But so as a relatively new investor, would you recommend gearing as many of my initial purchases at 90 to 95% LVR as possible to help get ahead early on? Or do you foresee a lot of the banks starting to restrict this type of lending going forward with the interest rates currently so low? If you do recommend it, how do we best manage the risk for the first few years until the properties grow and the loans come down to the 80% mark? And I should say, Ben, before you kick it off, that Andy sent this in probably before some recent changes, so it might be topical for us to start off on this one.
Yeah, so look, obviously the reason why you invest in property is usually a cash-on-cash return. So what we're talking about for cash-on-cash return is we're basically saying that our deposit or our dollar value, whether it be equity or the savings that we use, can be magnified. Okay, so by magnification, we're increasing the returns that we're getting on controlling a larger asset. Now, for me, and I think I've mentioned this in the podcast before, that's my love affair with property. It's not so much that I feel attached to it in terms of its beautiful aesthetics, because I don't necessarily, I mean, I do admire a great home, but I'm not doing it for that. I'm seeing it as a pure investment. And a traditional investment is one that you put your head down, bum up, and do the research and then execute on, and then you let it do its thing. I'm not talking about speculation. I'm not talking about equity harvesting. I'm not talking about all these other things, which we'll get into in other podcasts. What I'm focusing in on is how do we control that asset and how do we do it on two fronts. One, the equity or the savings that we bring to the table, and two, and most importantly for you, Andy, in terms of cash flow management. Now, we've spent a lot of time talking about the science of cash flow through previous episodes, so it's really important that you go back and revisit those, because the science of property investment, one of the key essentials in our ABCD is cash flow management, and B, obviously, borrowing power, Bryce.
Yeah, so if we talk about 90 to 95% LVR for the beginner investors, that's going to attract a mortgage insurance premium where the bank will charge you an amount of money for them to have the privilege of protecting their position, not your position. So I often have a discussion with investors around their views with respect to mortgage insurance, and quite often people have this negative overtone towards it because it's going to cost them some money. And if they're going to combine maybe two or three properties into the lending, those premiums can be quite high in the tens of thousands of dollars. But I've got a very firm view on mortgage insurance. Avoid it when you can.
Listen, everyone. I'm building it up. Listen.
Well, I think it's really important.
It's a cracker.
Avoid it when you can and embrace it when you have to, because as Ben said before about leverage, I think that leverage is the independent umpire towards any asset class that you're comparing, because ultimately the banks are very comfortable lending you up to 95% of its value, and they're also prepared quite often to capitalize the mortgage insurance, so sometimes up to 97%. So that's how much they place a premium on that type of security versus shares, where it's often at 50% for blue chip and businesses and all those sorts of things that have different risk weighting. So for me, it's often the independent umpire. Ben always says he's not in love with property. I agree with him. I'm in love with the outcome of property. And if we can get maximum leverage from residential real estate, that's a good thing. So in terms of your question, will they stop lending at 90 to 95% LVR? It's an important thing to remember that most people buy residential real estate in this country for their principal place of residence. And therefore, there's this equilibrium of 70% owner occupiers, 30% investors. Now, recently in Sydney, that was between 50 and 60% at certain types of lending being lent to investors. It's unsustainable, it's out of equilibrium, and it's a concern to all involved, particularly given that they're using interest rates as an instrument to sort of tweak with other parts of the economy. So to answer your question, will they stop lending at 90 to 95%? The answer is no, but they're severely restricting it right now.
They are, and I think it's the message that I want to sort of make sure we get through in this podcast is that, yep, we love gearing, but it also magnifies risk as well. So, you know, if we think it's sensible that you can manage it from a cash flow point of view and it's appropriate to your risk profile, then naturally you may gear to a higher percentage ratio than others would. So it does come down to personal circumstances, personal preferences, what you're willing to risk, because the reality, like what Bryce was just saying, if 50 to 60% of new transactions happening in the Sydney market are investment transactions, yet the long-term average is 30%, there's going to be some correction in that marketplace. And if people have geared themselves into 90, 95% positions, and some values retreat by 10, 15%, they're going to be in a negative equity position and they could lose money. So I want listeners to understand that as much as we love the magnification and the acceleration of which leverage can bring to the conversation, it's really important that our listeners understand that you shouldn't be gearing yourself to the Scheitenhausen, because it's only going to cause you a lot of grief in regards to, you know, if something goes wrong, if you lose your job, if you haven't provisioned a buffer in cash flow reserves and you've got to sell this property, it's high cost in, high cost out property. So you want to love it for the long term. And if you don't love it for the long term, you'll often lose money.
Now, asset selection is also critical in terms of it's one of the pillars, the four pillars we've spoken about. Now, the scariest thing right now is if you've gone 90 to 95% on an off the plan apartment that is yet to complete, yeah, in the Sydney market, that would be very, very scary, and there'd be a few nervous investors. So your question about how do we manage the risk, for me, if you do have the risk profile that suggests that you're comfortable paying mortgage insurance and you're comfortable leveraging up to the 90 to 95% level, for me, it's absolutely critical that you get the asset selection right.
Very much so, and when getting that asset selection right, the types of product out in the marketplace that we're not thrilled about at the moment is new greenfield estates, house and land packages, where we think that they've exceeded their fair market value in the Sydney market especially. So, you know, we're sort of seeing people pay $600,000 to $800,000 for a four-bed, two-bath out in the sticks. That's, for us, is unsustainable because interest rates won't stay low for the long term, and usually the majority of the people that live out in those locations are lower income earners, and they normally go for the mansions early in their life rather than playing the slow game. So that's a concern, and obviously we've talked about the off the plan stuff, which is a bit of a concern for us in medium and high density, and even in refill areas. We still think that people are going to pay a premium because they'll have this whole speculation sort of stuff going on, so it's a danger.
So there you go, Andy. Our view is that it's not for the faint-hearted, and will they? The banks currently via APRA are deciding that through a blunt instrument of changing some of their calculations in terms of assessments and also what percentage of the loan book can actually grow, what percentage growth can they have in their loan book for investors. It's their attempt to try and bring some of this speculative activity out of the marketplace. So in terms of your question, do we recommend gearing up to 90 to 95%? We can't give a recommendation, but it suits some people.
Case by case.
Case by case. And how do you best manage it? Asset selection is unbelievably critical. There's a point there we can talk about cross-collateralization, but that'll come up in one of our next questions.
Thanks, Andy.
Paul Harper has written in and said, "Hey, I love the podcast. Great to see a housing investment podcast that has some great non-biased info on the Australian housing market. It would be great if an episode could cover capital gains tax. I've recently had to sell an investment due to lifestyle decision, but didn't incur any charges as it was my first place, assuming PPR, principal place of residence. In future, if I have to sell to upgrade to a bigger investment, it would be great to know the CGT laws in each state. Cheers, Paul." Well, the good news is it's national, so each state.
I think the first thing is, yeah, it's a federal tax. It's not a state-based tax, and it forms part of your income. So effectively each year, the income that you generate can come in the form of wages that you earn, the business that you run, or potentially the sale of an asset. And in this case, it would be property. So there is an exemption, which is our principal place of residence, which carries that exemption. So the reality is, yep, you can continue to keep buying and selling if you want to, and you won't incur any capital gains tax. Some people, however, on the other hand, potentially get their foot on the property ladder and then they buy something and then they use that as their leverage into the next property. So rather than selling it, they may convert that into an investment property. And that's been a bit of my journey on building my portfolio out in being able to do that. So the reality is that you can only have one principal place of residence at one time. So if you are holding two properties, there are some provisions in there around capital gains events. The most important thing, and I'm not a licensed tax agent, so I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritty, but I will say the critical date is the date that from you leaving that property, 6 years after that date, I would encourage you to get a valuation on your property, and your tax advisor will explain to you what this means. But if you've been removed from your home for work reasons or for other reasons, you can rent that property out, and any capital gain that occurs could be capital gains tax free up to 6 years. So that's just something we want you to go and speak to a specialist tax advisor. We're not here to give you specialist tax advice, but the reality is that's one of the tax considerations you need to make. And if you've got two properties, you'll need to work out which one was your principal place of residence.
Good point there, Ben. So what he's saying is generally speaking, that's the rules, but go and talk to your tax accountant to get tax advice. There's a significant date for capital gains tax. On the run here, I'm pretty sure it's the 19th of September 1985. If you own a property prior to 1985, the capital gains tax rules don't apply to you. It's anything that's bought after 1985. I'll double check that date, yep. but it's around 1985. It coincides with when depreciation changes happened as well, because they took the negative gearing rules out in 1983. The other thing to think about too is in capital gains tax event, you only pay capital gains tax if you dispose of the asset. Now, we talked a couple of weeks ago about exit strategy. Now, one of our preferred exit strategies of the three was that you buy and hold these assets long term, retire the debt, and then pass it on through legacy to your heirs. So unless you sell the asset, capital gains tax is a moot point to you. So if you choose that particular exit strategy, it won't be an issue.
And it just highlights the need for tax planning. I mean, you know, you're going to have to put your hand in your pockets, people, to get great advice. You're not going to be able to learn all of these tax solutions and tax consequences without going to speak to a great tax accountant. And in some cases, they can save you thousands of dollars in tax. I mean, if you're paying tax, it means things are going fairly well for you. But in reality, yep, there are ways in which you can legally minimise your tax. So it's important that you go and speak to an advisor, a tax agent who can give you some advice around this. And one of the great things to ask them is, how much experience do you have in advising on residential real estate? Do you own a couple of investment properties yourself? Sometimes it's best to speak to a specialist. And I'll put a big note in here for PIPA. You can go onto the PIPA website, www.pipa.asn.au, and you can search for tax accountants who are members of the association. Now, if you're a tax accountant listening to this and you want to specialise in giving property investment advice, or tax advice on property, I should say, become a member of PIPA.
Good advice there, Ben. Very good advice. Andrew's written in another finance-related question. Hey, property couches.
There we go. We're the couches.
Last night I had
a client who's been listening saying, what do you call us? The couch cast.
Couch cast.
Yeah. So there's some, thanks for the feedback. We love it all.
We're happy with all sorts of sort of names, except for the person who gave us 2 out of 5 as a rating. We probably don't want to hear what he thinks of us, but he or she. I would like to take a quick opportunity to thank you for the Knowledge Sharing Podcast and definitely receive my vote in the Investor Choice Awards in 2015.
Thank you very much.
In recent episode number 20, you touched on cross-collateralization. And while it is not the best option, I was wondering if you could expand on where you might need to use it, why would you use it, and to what extent you use it, and how would you uncross-collateralize your portfolio? There's a bit in that, Ben.
There is. Do you want me to start?
Mate, you're the mortgage broker.
Okay, so to start with what we're talking about there is cross-collateralization or cross-securitization is basically grouping the securities and giving the banks one collective control over all of your securities. Now, what are some of the positives of doing that? Well, one of the positives of being cross-collateralized is that you can have your owner-occupied debt in one simple loan and all your investment debt in another simple loan, because effectively the bank is holding the multiple securities. So some people like that from ease of transacting and ease of understanding or managing their finances. So that might be one argument for sort of doing cross-collateralization. However, we talked about the negatives, which were every time you want to do something in terms of update, get a global limit, you've got to get all your properties revalued. If some of those properties have gone backwards or soft, then you know it's extra cost potentially in getting those valuations done by the bank. So what are some of the times where I would use cross-collateralization? Usually it comes down to if I've got an owner-occupied home, and instead of doing bridging finance, I'm looking to buy a new property. So I'll buy the new property using the equity and maybe a little bit of a buffer in terms of to secure and settle on the new property, subject to being able to service it, of course. And then with the view that if I'm going to sell that property, I would then do what we call a partial release of security. So effectively, the bank takes both securities. It's all held together nice and tightly, and then I would release that out. And it just saves doing a very complex bridging loan, and some lenders charge more for bridging loans, so there's more administrative fees. So in some cases, I would use cross-collateralization or securitization where I would be doing that. So repeating that, nice and simple, I'm putting both houses together, I'm taking out a new loan for the new home, and then I'm selling off the old property, and then I'm paying down the loan from those proceeds, or in most cases, I'd be putting in an offset account as an example. What are the other points?
Well, I think just some of the negatives too, Ben, because you talked about the principal place of residence. For me, the cross-securitization or the cross-collateralization, which is always hard to say, it's not good for property investment portfolio builders because you can end up with glass ceilings. And as you hinted on it, but it's a really good point, is if you've got two properties that are cross-securitized, and let's just say they're both worth 500, and theoretically one goes up to 550 and one falls to 450, the net is no growth. 50 up, 50 down, zero.
Correct.
Versus if you have standalone, you could actually ignore the one that went down in value and go and attack the one that actually went up in value and then maybe get some more lending to further leverage. So ultimately for me, that netting off and the glass ceilings, and by glass ceilings, I had a client that was once working with me when I was living in Brisbane. And they had a very significant seven-figure portfolio, and they were with one of the four-pillar banks. And the bank felt uncomfortable, felt like they were an unreasonable risk to continue to give them more, even though on paper they could service more debt and their equity allowed them to get more. But their bank policy said no. Whereas if you aren't cross-securitized and you do have multiple lenders in that scenario as being a portfolio builder, you can just walk around to the bank that suits your that has the policy that suits what you're looking to do.
I think, you know, no different than big business. If a mine is looking to be built and they need to raise $500 million, usually the banks will spread risk. So the main, like the primary lender might take a $300 million position, the secondary lender take a $150 million position, and the third lender take a $50 million position. And that's about hedging and spreading risk. As you get more and more sophisticated in your portfolio, you would usually have two, possibly even a third lender, because it's about getting the deal done as opposed to just basically having all of your property in one lender thinking you're getting a slightly better discount because of your aggregated borrowing amounts. We don't necessarily concur with having the cheapest loan. It's all about making sure that we're controlling the biggest amount of property under sensible lending relationships and getting that done. Now, the final point here is how do you uncross? So if you are crossed, and this is, again, it's a default position of all banks. So if you've gone and you've got a personal banker, or if you've got it, you've gone directly to a bank instead of using a broker, you will usually have your portfolio cross-securitized. It's a default position. It's what they're trained to do, and they won't even talk to you about having uncrossed securities. So the best people to go and talk to is a licensed mortgage broker.
Investment savvy.
Investment savvy licensed mortgage broker, exactly right, Bryce. And they would be able to then give you your options around the current lender you're with, or if you're going to refinance. When you are refinancing, that will give us the ability to be able to advise the lender that based on the valuations of each of the property, this is how we're going to structure our lending. Now, when you are structuring your lending, remember how I said earlier that you would have a very simplistic loan structure. The loan structure is a little bit more complex in the sense that you will separate your owner-occupier debt and your personal debt from your investment debt, and you may have a couple of loan splits associated with the purpose of those funds. So in other words, if we've got a principal home and we've got $100,000 in personal debt, that would be a personal loan. And then loan number two might be the equity release, which might be another $100,000. And you just go on and bought another $500,000 property, that $100,000 and the $400,000 against the second property, which represents a 80% loan to value ratio will combine to be the debt against that property and be deductible. So a little bit more technical, but that's basically how it works.
There you go, folks. 20 years plus of experience just right there. Rewind that if you didn't catch it, because it's quite technical but very, very good. Now, Ben, I just wanted to talk about an example of a client who I'm recently working with. One of our team here is looking to uncross her security. She had six investment properties that were all crossed. And so just for the listeners' benefit, when I'm doing my role as a buyer's agent, I have an internal term, what I call incubation.
Yep.
Basically, that means if a client engages me and they're not yet ready to go, I put them in incubation because I want them to be finance ready. I want to be focused on price, not on terms and conditions when I'm negotiating, so I want to be ready.
But you want to have the power to negotiate, don't you? So if you know that everything's lined up, all your ducks are in a row, you can make some strong negotiating tactics to get the job done.
Absolutely. So that incubation process, it's how long's a piece of string, but typically for someone who needs to get some equity release, get a pre-approval, it's, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's taken us 8 to 10 weeks to get her ready to be able to buy, to uncross. And it was a lot of time and energy and effort from our team to get her in that position to be ready to go uncross collateralized, standalone lending so that we can move forward. So
move forward with flexibility and be dynamic. And that's what it's all about.
So it's happening in the real world. So there you go, Andrew. Thanks for that question regarding cross-collateralization. So, Ben, I can't believe it, but we're actually getting through a number of these.
Oh,
so
it's good. It's good.
SMSF. This is from Billy. I'm interested in using a self-managed super fund to invest in super in my property. I'd like to hear your opinions on this subject. Would you recommend it or not? First thing we've got to obviously say here is, we're not licensed to give anything other than general advice.
No, we aren't. And even with general advice, because, and you'll hear me, I don't call them SMSFs anymore. I was actually doing a presentation a couple of years back where I was presenting, and ASIC was also presenting at the same event. And we referred to them as SMURFs, just easy to say. So a SMURF is a licensed investment product. So even giving general advice is not permissible unless you're a fully qualified financial planner. But what we can talk about is statements of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important for people to understand from a self-managed super fund, a SMURF's point of view, you can only be recommended to set up a self-managed super fund through a licensed financial planner and currently also through an accountant. Now, there will be a period in time that accountants will need to get their diploma of financial services, and then they'll be the only people who can advise on the appropriateness of setting up a self-managed super fund. Now, I'll quickly just talk about these statements of fact again, and we encourage you to go and seek professional advice on this. Super is a tax structure, okay? It is a structure that has been set up by government to encourage savings, because the reality is that people can't save money.
Because I think that's an important point, because if you think about super, you can often think it's like a share or it's like it's not. It's just a vehicle.
It is.
It's a structural vehicle to invest in.
It is a structural vehicle, because back in 93 and earlier than that, the Keating government got the shock of their lives in knowing that they wouldn't be able to pay out pensions to everyone. So rather than encouraging people to go off and save money, the Australian public doesn't do it en masse. They're useless at managing money. So this was a forced saving mechanism, and the government put some incentives around being encouraging people to put some money in there. So there are some tax concessions if you pay with your pre-tax income to put that money into superannuation. Now, the development of a SMURF and the changing in the SMURF space was around being able to borrow money. Now, the actual self-managed super fund doesn't borrow the money, but a structure is set up which allows the super fund to borrow money. So just like a big institutional fund, if you set up a self-managed super fund, you are required under the obligations as the trustee of that fund, and this is the important message for all listeners, that you can outsource the caretaking and you can help get a financial planner to give you some investment advice and a property investment advisor to give you property advice, but you cannot outsource the responsibility. Ultimately, the buck will stop with you. So there is no protection. If you stuff this up, you risk losing your super. And if you don't comply with the onerous obligations around managing that in terms of it's audited every year, you've got to have full detailed records of everything you're doing around your super fund, then it may not be the most appropriate vehicle to get the best returns. Now, for those people who are very good at managing money, who have a lot of attention to detail and take an interest in this, and what I would say are more sophisticated than the average mum and dad, then this type of product would be worth talking to your financial planner about. Now, on the property side, we can talk about what property does. It does exactly the same thing. And there are some positives around property. The most important thing around the positives on property, and I'm speaking too long here, Bryce, I'll give you a go in a second. But the reality is that when you sell the property during the accumulation phase, the capital gain event is only 10%. Now, any extra money that you contribute is 15% taxable, and any capital gain event, if you do sell it whilst in accumulation phase, is only taxable at 10%, as opposed to if we sell it out, if we buy it in our own name and we sell that property, it's a 50, you get a 50% concession, and then the remaining 50% is added to your income for that year, and then you pay tax on that. So for some people, it does allow for a nice vehicle, and at the moment, a Smurfs and any type of super in pension phase is tax-free. Mm. So there can be some incentives around setting them up. But I suspect viewers, our listeners, what's going to happen in this space is there will be some changes to super. And I suspect in the next 20 years or so, there will be some tax payable by those people. So I think it'll be means tested and people got a really lot of money in super. They'll have to start paying their fair share of tax.
Very good points. A couple of bullet points for me. Be careful of the spruiker who's using the SMSF, or as Ben said, the Smurf, as a vehicle to get you to buy a property, because it all comes back to asset selection. I'm seeing too many people buying really ordinary assets in their super fund. The other thing is I've got a client now who's wants me to buy an asset for them in their super fund, and they've said to me, which city should I buy in? And I said, well, this is a long-term asset, so why wouldn't you keep it in the safety of the country? And this might annoy some of our non-Melbourne and Sydney listeners, but I would say keep it in the security of these long-term metropolises in terms of their long-term growth. Are there opportunities? Absolutely there are. Mm. But if you're not going to actually be able to touch this for 10 or 20 years, go with the security of the numbers in those big cities. And also, this particular client came in and said, look, I want to buy. I've had the self-managed super fund set up for a year. Can we buy? And so I introduced him to our financial planner here. And basically what we found out very quickly is that he couldn't get any lending until a financial planner had signed off on the plan. Right. So
which is sensible.
So to have a financial planner go through and make sure that you're buying the right asset, because in talking to Michael, who's our financial planner, his mind works like a computer. It's just amazing. He talks about there's a sweet spot in terms of the purchase price, because when you talked about getting into pension phase, there's certain rules about how much you've got to pay out of the super fund to you. And if your assets aren't liquid enough, or you don't have enough cash within the fund, you could find yourself in a very compromised position. So if you've got 700 or a million to spend in the super fund, doesn't necessarily mean you'd pay that amount for an asset because of liquidity down the track. The important point here is you need to talk to a licensed financial planner.
Get some professional advice. But the vehicle does stack up, but it's not for everyone.
Not for everyone. There you heard it, folks. The Property Investment Advisor of the Year telling it's not for everyone. Billy Brownlee, thank you for that message. And I think we've covered off 5 questions. That's probably a record
four.
For us.
I think it was 4.
More? 4.
We might have answered sub-questions within the questions, but yeah.
Maybe 4. All right. Who would have thought the Collingwood supporters right?
Again.
Oh, very good, very good. All right, well, folks, there you have it. We have covered off a few questions. We really appreciate all the positive feedback that we're getting about the Property Couch. We're finding that it's hitting a really great nerve out there, Ben, because we're trying to give back to an industry that's been good to us, that's served us personally within our own portfolios and served us professionally. So we're really glad that the goal, 25 plus, I don't know how many episodes it is now, but quite a while ago we started with this idea about whether or not we'd get this podcast off the ground, and clearly it's working. So thanks again to the listeners for tuning in each week. And I guess, as per usual, if you go to our social media sites, Facebook, Instagram, that's where you find out first that our episode is out.
Ah, okay. I didn't know that.
So all the social media fans can find out first when it's coming out by going to Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, and also leaving us some questions for the future. Now, mate, it's becoming I'm intrigued every week now. I come in here and I'm thinking, in which language are
you're we... You're only intrigued because I pick up a piece of paper about 10 seconds ago trying to look for something that I can sign off with.
This is the magic of podcast, mate.
This is the magic
of... You don't have to reveal the recipe.
It's the only thing I have to prep each week. I mean, everything else I come in, I just do straight off the cuff. And it's the only thing I've got to think about in terms of being able to sign off in a goodbye language. So,
and as you can hear, folks, it even takes a little while for the cogs to tick over.
I'm just trying to find one that I can do. Is it Zhang Zizhang? 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 Is that Chinese Mandarin? Is that...
Sounded very Chinese to me.
For all of our Chinese listeners, please correct me on the pronunciation. I'm very sorry, but it's either Zhizhang? Zhang? Yeah, something along those lines. So...
See what it gets to, folks? I mean, at some point I think that we have some intuitive and some insightful things to say.
Underneath it says Mandarin, it says bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Maybe that one works.
Do that one better.
There you go, folks. Bye-bye, and we'll see you next week.
See you soon.